It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wakebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
It goes beyond cheating the individual, whether it's a day laborer or a person in a low-income job who really doesn't have the economic power, leverage to deal with the employers, just afraid that they may not have a check or a job if they do challenge it. It allows dishonest employers to gain a competitive advantage over honest employers who are following the law. And, you know, it's something that as a society we need to address.
Employment law attorney and friend of the show, Harris Butler, talks about wage theft, how to spot it, and what to do about it. And what to do when the water is cut off due to non-payment, and how to get it cut back on, is discussed during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 94, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. A major reform within the 2010 Health Care Reform Act took effect earlier this month, the same day Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli presented argument to support his lawsuit that claims national health care reform is unconstitutional. Effective July 1, 2010, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, will offer a high-risk pool to Virginians who have been uninsured for at least 6 months and who have been denied coverage because of pre-existing health conditions. Individuals can apply for quality, affordable health coverage through a new pre-existing condition insurance plan, or PCIP. PCIP premiums will be similar to premiums charged to healthy people in Virginia. Coverage may begin as early as August. According to Families USA, 1.5 million Virginians under age 65 have a diagnosed pre-existing condition that could lead to a denial of coverage in the individual health insurance market. Applications are now available online at www.pcip.gov. The new coverage and information about the complete range of health coverage options available for Virginia consumers can be found by zip code on an HHS website, www.healthcare.gov. The new website will give consumers and small businesses information about private insurance, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, or FAMIS, Medicare, and other coverage options. The new plans for the uninsured with pre-existing conditions will serve as a bridge to 2014, when the reform law bans denials of coverage based on pre-existing conditions. Many thousands of uninsured Virginians with even minor health problems have been denied coverage, charged exorbitant premiums, or subjected to lengthy waiting periods. They now will have a great new option to get health insurance. Other health reform provisions that are already helping Virginians are extended insurance coverage for children up to age 26, 2010 tax credits for small businesses providing health insurance, and $250 checks for seniors in the Medicare Part D prescription drug donut hole. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for the answer to our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? Last week, we gave you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which was incorrect. Here's last week's question. Which two things are true about security deposits in rental housing? A. The security deposit draws interest if held for more than 13 months. B. The landlord can use the security deposit for unpaid rent and for repairs beyond reasonable wear and tear. Or C. The tenant can pay the last month's rent with the security deposit. The correct answers are A. The security deposit draws interest if held for more than 13 months, and B. The landlord can use the security deposit for unpaid rent and for repairs beyond reasonable wear and tear. The security deposit may not be used to pay the last month's rent because the security deposit doesn't have to be returned until 45 days after the tenant has moved. Later in the show, we'll give you this week's quiz. Is that legal? For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
Irma from Chester, Virginia.
Welcome to the show. What are we talking about this week?
Public utilities.
Okay, what question do we have?
I would like to know, what help could a person seek out if they had lost income, they have very limited income at the present, their water is off, and the public utilities department with the water department wants the outstanding balance in full, which is a large sum, along with a hefty security deposit.
And let me ask one other question or two before I answer your question. What water department are we talking about?
Chesterfield Water Department.
Okay, and this is Chesterfield County?
Chesterfield County.
That's a really good question. I don't have a great answer for you. If this were a public utility, that is not a government-run utility, but a public utility like, Dominion Power or something of that nature, they're regulated by the State Corporation Commission, and they have a complaint line, which is 804-371-9611. But they only regulate the private utility companies that are, you know, publicly regulated by the government. If it's a governmental agency that's actually running the water and sewer utility, they're pretty much self-regulating. So whether if you're getting your water from City of Richmond Water Department or Chesterfield County Water Department, they're pretty much self-regulating. Now, if you have the water, you use the water, and you get billed for the water, you're expected to pay for it. And if you can't pay for it, they do have the right at a certain point to cut it off. But at the same time, you have a right to service because, after all, it's not like you can go to the other water company and get your water from them. So what I always advise people in that situation to do is what you've already apparently done is contact the water company itself and try to work out a payment arrangement with them. But then to not get stopped at the first level, if the person you're talking with is unhelpful to you, then to talk to a supervisor of that person. And if that person is not helpful, to talk to the supervisor of that person. And basically all the way up the chain of command until you get to you know, whoever is at the head of the water department. If that still is not helpful, certainly for people in the city of Richmond, I advise folks to contact their city council person, because city council people can often intervene with city departments and say, look, I got this person here, they're really in hardship, they're willing to make arrangements and, you know, get them their water cut back on. I would advise the same thing for Chesterfield County. I would advise contacting whoever is your member of the Board of Supervisors, and, you know, again, assuming you've already gone through the water department and you just completely struck out, and explaining your situation to the member of the Board of Supervisors. They do this type of thing all the time. And the member of the Board of Supervisors may be willing to contact the water department and say, look, we got this person. It's tough economic times. They're willing to make arrangements. They need water. Work with them.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here in Chaco's Lip at the law firm of Butler, Williams & Skilling, and we're talking with friend of the show and former guest, Harris Butler. He is an attorney with the firm. Welcome to the show, Harris.
Thank you.
We are going to be talking today about wage theft. What do we mean by wage theft?
Well, wage theft is really epidemic in the country right now, and it's where workers are not paid for the work they have done, and it takes several different forms. You know, there's simply the non-payment of work when somebody has performed work and just has not been paid, something that day laborers often suffer, and there's other industries that sometimes you'll see that, but also, you know, not receiving a last paycheck or having deductions taken from a paycheck that are unauthorized. And there's specific provisions in state law that prevent or restrict that, prohibit that. You know, not receiving overtime compensation for hours worked. And there's variations on that, on how employers either are misclassifying employees as exempt from the overtime laws or the minimum wage laws, or cheating them on hours. And then there's also the issue of pay inequities based on gender or race, where, for instance, a woman is paid less for doing the same job as a man.
So let's take that list one at a time. You started with unauthorized wage deductions. When can an employer deduct from wages, and when can they not?
Well, actually, employers have no authority to deduct anything from wages unless the employee gives them a signed and written authorization that allows them to deduct. And so if you have a last paycheck and the employer, you know, it's something like when we were in college and you have that apartment deposit that you never expect to see. The last paycheck, sometimes employers will... I mean, they're not going to have to see the employee the next week, and they'll deduct items. They may charge an employee for tools or deduct for things that they're not authorized to deduct. And, you know, you also see it on last paychecks with people simply not receiving a paycheck or being delayed in receiving a paycheck for sometimes months. And the law says, as to last paychecks, Virginia law says that you have to be paid at the same time that you would otherwise be paid. So if you're on an every 2 week pay schedule, then 2 weeks after your termination, you should receive at the next pay date the last compensation.
So what are the remedies that are available to folks who have unauthorized wage deductions, or they just don't get their final paycheck, or they're a day laborer and they're just cheated out of their wages?
Well, there's basically two ways that this can be approached. One is, when an individual hires someone, engages someone to perform a job or a duty, then it's a promise to pay. So that's a contract. It may not be in writing, it may not be formalized, but it's an obligation to honor the agreement. So the employee could file a claim in small claims court, depending on the amount of money involved, but could go to the courts. I'm sure at Legal Aid you see, you know, many, many claims that way, of that sort. But there's also the State Department of Labor and Industry that will field those claims. It's tax dollars. That's why they're there. And they can then have the weight of the state government behind them to investigate and initiate proceedings against the employer. And likely, if it's happened to one person, it's not isolated. It's happened to others. And the beauty of that is that maybe the practice can be stopped. And it's really, it goes beyond cheating the individual, whether it's a day laborer or a person in a low-income job who really doesn't have the economic power or leverage to deal with the employer, is just afraid that they may not have a check or a job if they do challenge it. It allows dishonest employers to gain a competitive advantage over honest employers who are following the law. And, you know, it's something that as a society we need to address.
Well, let's talk about the overtime and minimum wage issues that you mentioned earlier. What are the rules there and who enforces those rules?
This is an area, minimum wage and overtime, that is among the various laws that protect employees is probably one of the best laws. It is one of the easiest laws to enforce because the rules are very clear. If you are in a position where you're entitled to overtime and minimum wage, then an employer must pay time and a half overtime for all hours worked in a work week over 40 in a week, and they must pay, you know, the prevailing minimum wage. The issue there is that some employers make it look like, I mean, they'll give you a check where it'll say, you know, a certain number of hours worked, but they may have fudged the hours, or they may not have counted all the hours. You know, we have a case right now where they block out automatically a lunch hour, but the employees work through that. They don't pay for that hour, but they're not off for that hour. And, you know, breaks, for instance, are under the laws to be compensated and not deducted. This same employer has on their worksheets inked in a, you know, a pre-printed form that shows a start time of 7 a.m., let's say. And often employees are actually performing work for the employer before 7 a.m., yet they're not paid for that.
So I have a two-part question here. I guess one is, how does the employee dispute the employer's written records of you took an hour lunch, but the employee really didn't, or you came in at 7 and the employee really came in at 6? And, you know, part two is, assuming you can dispute the employer's records, what's your remedy? Where do you go?
Okay. Great question. Because, again, you've got this kind of mismatch of power and control of the documents. The employer has everything. The employee has very little. The employee knows he or she's being cheated, yet how do you prove it? And the law, again, is very, very strong in this regard. The law requires the employer to keep records, accurate time records and hour records, and there are penalties for either fudging on those records or just simply not keeping the records. And where there are not accurate records, the law says that the employee's best estimate is good enough. And so just because the employer has a written record that shows something that's less than what is the true amount of time worked, actually, the law favors the employee's best estimate of those work of the hours worked, and many, many of our cases involve just that, where the records, whether they're electronic computer records or their handwritten records, are just fabricated, or they're wrong in certain respects, and the law is very good about that. So you can prove those cases. Now, what do you get? I mean, what kind of remedy is there? Again, there's a state system and a federal system that protects overtime and minimum wage. The federal system is the primary, the Federal Department of Labor is the primary enforcement mechanism. They often, though, again, because of limited resources, concentrate on large employers who have systemic or large practices that apply to a lot of people. But they certainly investigate, and I know right now the Wage Hour Division and the current administration is very active. They've put new dollars, hired more people to investigate these at the Federal Department of Labor, and both in the Wage Hour Division and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance, very, very aggressive, and the Obama administration is very committed to seeing that these laws are enforced. Now, these laws also allow private lawyers to enforce those rights, and as a practical matter, that's where kind of the rubber hits the road. That's where most of these rights are vindicated, because there's a big incentive for employees who aren't paid overtime and for attorneys to take these cases. And that is what the law allows you to recover is you can go back 2 years and recover unpaid minimum wage or overtime. And if you can show a willful violation, which is not a very high standard because everybody knows the labor laws are there and you're supposed to follow them, you can go back 3 years. And if you have not received your pay when you were due, and we talked about if that's every 2 weeks or if you're in some cases salaried every month, then you can recover an equal amount of the unpaid overtime back 2 or 3 years, doubled. I mean, it's called liquidated damages, and the law says if you weren't paid the wages, your overtime wages when they were due, then you're entitled to a doubling of everything in addition to what you should have received, twice that. So you're also entitled to recover your cost of court and your attorney's fees. So it's a very, very, our system is designed and the law is designed to encourage these claims to be prosecuted, to encourage people to come forward. There's also a mechanism in the law that allows people to join together and group together in what some people might refer to as something like a class action. It's really under the overtime laws called a collective action. It's a group of people. One person can start it, and then the court will send notice to everybody, requires the employer to provide the names and addresses of everyone, and notice goes out, and large groups of people can participate in that. And we've done a number of those, and it's very successful because that's the same type of pressure that the government can bring to bear on an employer who's violating the rules.
That sounds like a very promising remedy. The last thing you mentioned was pay inequities. Could you talk briefly about those as well?
Certainly. There's one law in particular, the Equal Pay Act, and actually it's related to the Fair Labor Standards Act, the overtime law, same legislative platform, that Congress recognized that women in the same job, same duties, same category, were often paid much less than their male counterparts. And so the Equal Pay Act allows recoveries on the same kind of standard that the overtime laws do, 2 years for a violation, 3 years for willful, and a doubling or liquidating of damages plus attorney's fees and costs, where you can show a pay inequity. And what we see is, you know, somebody might have been working for, in some job as a middle manager, let's say, and the man is paid for the same job, the man's paid $30,000 and the woman's paid $20,000. And you can go back now and recover those for those periods of time. There's also been some legislation for the gender and race. Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act protects more than just gender. But the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was the first bill that President Obama signed into law. And that actually protects pay inequities based on discriminatory practices.
And that is a wonderful way to end the interview. We have been talking with Harris Butler. He is an attorney at the firm of Butler, Williams, and Skilling in Shaco Slip. Among other things, they handle employment discrimination cases as well as wage theft cases. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
It's time for our weekly quiz called, Is That Legal? We give you a legal question and three possible answers, one of which is incorrect, and we give the correct answers next week. If you're the first to email the two correct answers, we'll post your name on our show's website and send you a free copy of the Virginia State Bar's Handbook on Your Legal Rights and Responsibilities. Here's this week's question. When you apply for Social Security or SSI disability benefits, which two things is the Social Security Administration required to look at? A, your education, B, the past work you did, or C, whether you would be hired if you applied for work.
If you know the two correct answers, email them by Friday to marty@cvlas.org and be next week's winner. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. Although legally in this country, H-2A migrant farm workers face major cultural, geographic, and language barriers in accessing their legal rights. Join us next week when Christian Quiroz, director of the Virginia Farm Workers Legal Assistance Project, describes how her staff of three provides legal assistance to more than 2,500 farm workers every year in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on April 22, 2009. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. Oh.